Hi, this is Joe Elliott.
And Rick Savage, and we're from Def Leppard, and we're in the studio.
Def Leppard, in many ways, was the definitive hard rock band of the 80s. There were many bands that rocked harder and were more dangerous than the Sheffield Quintet, but few others captured the spirit of the times quite as well, states Stephen Thomas Erlewine in the All Music Guide. And you know, he's absolutely right. Rick Savage and Pete Willis had a band as teenagers in the Yorkshire steel factory town of Sheffield, and Joe Elliott joined as singer, bringing the name Def Leppard in 1977. Steve Clark was added as second lead guitarist, and an adolescent drummer, Rick Allen, completed the lineup. Here's Joe Elliott in the studio.
Where I actually grew up, all the neighborhood kids were about 15 years old when I was like 9 or 10.
So you hung out with
people. So when I was like 9, I was listening to Aqualung by Jethro Tull, Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson.
At 9?
Yeah, Thick as a Brick, all that kind of stuff, as well as Rod Stewart, you know, like Every Picture Tells a Story, what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
But then when I started to try and develop my own kind of pop taste as well, I mean, I did like those, but I had no option but to, because that's what they were all listening to. The first thing that really blew me away completely was T-Rex with his song called Get It On.
No kidding.
I saw them on Top of the Pops and I thought, I saw Mark Bolan and he had all this long curly hair, women's shoes on, believe it or not, and like all these scarves and velvet trousers. I mean, look, probably looking back now, I looked a right idiot, but I just looked at him and I thought, wow, what a guy. I want to be him. And then it was about a year after that I got into Mott the Hoople big time.
Oh, Mott, yes.
And ever absolutely. Since, I've, like, Ian Hunter's been my all-time hero.
Yeah.
first imported from England on a vinyl 45 RPM single with a small hole in the center. I played Rock Brigade on the radio in Memphis, Tennessee in 1980 until Def Leppard agreed to travel there and perform. On that first U.S. tour, Def Leppard drummer Rick Allen, who had just turned 16, was so young that he was technically working in the U.S. illegally. Here's lead singer Joe Elliott, followed by guitarist Phil Collin.
What did you study in school? How did you get out?
Choice of words is study.
What were you supposed to be studying?
Next question.
What does study mean? No, it's everything that anybody studies, you know, English, mathematics.
Just the usual
geography,
stuff.
You know, woodwork. All the things in life that come in really useful when you're singing a rock and roll band. All the normal, just general stuff, but I was just one of them kids that that used to get the school reports that said, does have the intelligence but lacks the effort, you know. I just couldn't be bothered. I always knew I'd be okay. I took my exams. I didn't swap for them. I passed them. My mind really was elsewhere. I was either going to be a rock and roller or a footballer.
A soccer player.
Yeah.
Rock and roll or a soccer player, a football player. So that was really a big
I actually told my careers teacher that.
Did you really?
Yeah.
They laughed at me when I said I was going to be a guitarist. They said, oh, well, I don't think you're going to be able to do that. Perhaps you work in a guitar factory or something.
Oh, guitar factory?
Yeah. I said, no, you don't understand. I want to play it. And they said...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to take into consideration, they have to think like that, because 99.9% of the kids at school don't end up doing what we're doing.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is fact, you know.
Absolutely.
But there's always the one little sticking point, like me and Phil, that's going to turn around and say, well, you're wrong, pal. You know? And... You know, we were lucky to get kind of break out and get away with it. You know, we
Absolutely.
Had the courage of our convictions at least.
Yeah.
Originally on Def Leppard's 1981 second album, High and Dry, that's Bring It On the Heartbreak, the turning point for young Joe Elliott, trying to make his way in the industrial factory world by day in order to play his music at night, came one day when he saw the writing on the wall, so to speak.
They kicked me out for playing cricket down in the basement.
For playing cricket in the basement of the factory?
With a Bakelite knob, which is like a very heavy, like a top of a gear stick. It went through a window. They went to impress.
And so that was the end of your career at Osborne?
Well, they didn't fire me. They just came and said, there's opportunities for you to kind of leave. I think you should take them. So I did. They handed me £500, which paid off my part of the PA that
we
had.
How much is that?
And I got a job, $800 maybe.
Yeah, they gave you about $800.
And that was a Friday. And then the following Tuesday, I got a job as a van driver. Which also came in very, very handy because I could take the van home at night.
Yeah, I progressed to a van driver for the next job I had after the Burger Alarm Factory. And I was driving motorcycles around London delivering things.
But the vans came in handy because when you're in a band, you see, you can throw all your gear in the back of them and go and do a gig. And you don't have to rent a van. So it's like I was getting jobs that were based around the band, you know.
Yeah.
But we all had the jobs to pay off. The good thing about it was that we were working as not like 8:30 till 4 in the day or 7:30 till 5 or whatever hours we had, earning money. And then from, we would go home and have something to eat, and then 6:30, 7 o'clock till maybe midnight, we'd be down at this old spoon factory rehearsing. And we had an income of maybe $250 a week between us, which would pay for...
Total?
Yeah, total.
All of the members of the band, you got about $250 a week?
Yeah, I was on £16-17 a week when I started at Osborne's, which is about $30 a week.
Oh,
it did go up. It did get higher the older you got, but it wasn't much more. Maybe $300 a week, which you would pay for your board and your cigarettes and your booze, and pay off your 10 quid a week for a guitar or a PA or whatever we bought. We'd be down there till midnight and then we'd have no money, so we'd be walking home in midwinter, 7 or 8 miles, and then getting up at 7:30 to go to work. I mean, it's every band that's ever made it has done that. It's no big deal. You know, that's part of the thing that you have to go. That's your apprenticeship. That makes you appreciate what's happening now, is remembering what it was like.
True, yeah,
you always have this affection for it because you know that you'll never go back to that.
Up next, Rick Savage joins Joe Elliott and Phil Collin to discuss how the launch of MTV just prior to their Pyromania album affected their career.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Phil Collin of Def Leppard.
Hi, this is Joe Elliott.
And Rick Savage, and we're from Def Leppard, and we're in the studio.
Way to go, guys. Congratulations to you and the members of Def Leppard for your induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. British hard rock producer Tom Allom had done Def Leppard's first On Through the Night. Robert John Lang, known as Mutt, was brought in for High and Dry and Pyromania. Mutt Lang had gained a great reputation very quickly by scoring multi-million sellers twice for AC/DC in Highway to Hell and Back in Black, followed by Foreigner 4. Here's Def Leppard lead singer Joe Elliott in the studio.
He knew that we were then restless and very impatient, and he knew that there was a certain energy that he wanted to capture of this young, energetic, fast, hard-rocking band.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, he wanted to take us one stage further than Tom had done. So there's like this compromise going off that neither of us knew about. It's like he'd be kind of trying to lean us in one direction, but trying to not lose the energy by not making us keep doing it over and over again to get perfection. So it's like he'd compromise himself a little bit, standard-wise, and we were compromising ourselves energy-wise, and we ended up with this very energetic, but pretty much better than the first album.
High and Dry record. Definitely was a step.
Is when we were doing pre-production for High and Dry, we had the songs and we just turned up with them and we did them, and little changes that got made didn't warrant any major credits or anything. And everybody's quite happy with that. But with Pyromania, it was basically six people sat around in a circle facing each other, bouncing ideas off. So it was like, we'd sat down and said, listen, On Through the Night had done so many copies and been reasonably successful. High and Dry was a much better album and was slightly better.
Aided immensely by a then-new media phenomenon that seemed to have young Americans transfixed, a 24-hour music television network, MTV. I asked Def Leppard co-founder, bass player Rick Savage, how the launch of MTV affected Def Leppard's career in general.
I think in a huge way, in fairness. I think MTV were, they were starting, they were actually just becoming popular around about the same time as we were, and it ended up being like a mutual thing, in fairness. They were great for us, and I think looking back, we were great for them. They started playing Bringing On The Heartbreak from the High and Dry album, and it set up the release of the Pyromania album so well that, because it was like a preempt, and everybody was like, all of a sudden the name was around, MTV was getting more and more popular in its own right, and then it just gave us that little launching pad for when Photograph came out, that it just made it so much easier to actually, you know, get the band across to everybody in America. And obviously it has to dovetail with the radio as well. And the two things just seem to slot into place.
When did you realize that you were becoming video stars, and in Joe in particular, a sex symbol in America?
One thing, we never enjoy making videos. It's always a pain in the arse. It really is. It's time-consuming. It's very tedious. It's more tedious than making some of our previous records. And because of that, you it's great to actually know that you're getting played and to sometimes actually see yourself on TV. I don't think you ever lose the thrill of that, no matter who you are. But I think that's as far as it goes. We're pretty down-to-earth people, and we really don't take each other that seriously. Honestly, I mean, I know maybe everybody can say this, but we never, ever... I mean, it's hideous, actually, just the thought of it. It's like, it's great getting the exposure, and I think maybe we probably looked upon it more in a business sense than in some sort of egotistical way.
Next, the little band from Sheffield explodes like a starburst. But not all of the original Yorkshire lads will be able to make the transition to world-class rock and roll band. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Joe Elliott, Phil Collin, and Rick Savage.
This is Joe Elliott from Def Leppard.
Welcome back. This is Rick Savage from Def Leppard, and we are in the studio with Redbeard.
When Henry Ford made his famous quote about success being 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration, he could have just as easily learned it from a working world-class rock band as from an auto assembly line. First, Def Leppard lead singer Joe Elliott, then lead guitarist Phil Collin.
There's a lot of snobbery musicianship where you'll get certain people won't listen to up-and-coming bands because they automatically think, oh, we're better than them, so I won't bother listening to them. Instead of always constantly looking up to the guy you learnt off, like, say, Richie Blackmore's and your Jeff Beck's of the world or your Eric Clapton's, and continuously staying behind, he's doing the same thing to the younger guys as well. And that is another major contributing factor into keeping the band always fresh, because what you can end up doing is you develop a style, which eventually is your own. I mean, anybody's first album is a
derivative,
conglomeration,
sure,
of everything you've listened to for 20 years.
It's impossible not to.
Then you develop your own style. And the mistake that a lot of bands make, i.e. say Uriah Heep in the 70s, is they stick to this style all the way through and it never changes.
They clone themselves and then it starts sounding like that. And then it starts sounding dated. So, I mean, if you stay one step ahead of that, the worst crime a band could do is sound dated.
Yeah.
You know? And it only sounds like that if you're not fresh and enthusiastic. So, yeah, you can play kind of old-fashioned type music, you know, whatever you want to call it. But if you've got conviction and everything, it still sounds cool. We're not a rock band who contrives a pop song or a pop band that contrives a rock sound. It's just anything that sounds good to us. Is that so, you know, I think there's a difference there with some bands. They're a rock band and they get this pop song. It's not really them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it'll stand out as the one track out of 10 that's not them.
Right.
Or whatever. With us, we've always tried to go for variety.
Yeah, but it's a natural thing. You know, a lot of the bands in England were just too far into the heavy metal type thing and there wasn't a lot of songs going off. And that's the great thing about Def Leppard, you know, there's songs. You can actually sit there and sing them as well.
Midway through the recording of Pyromania, Def Leppard co-founder guitarist Pete Willis was fired for problems related to alcohol. He was replaced by Phil Collin. Yet Steve Clark would be tolerated for the same addiction for another 8 years. To explain, first Joe Elliott, then Rick Savage.
They weren't that different. Pete Willis was given 100 chances before he was fired, over a shorter period of time. In a nutshell, Steve was a nice guy, and Pete wasn't. And no disrespect to Pete. When Pete was sober, he was funny. He was a great guitarist. When Pete drank, and he wasn't very tall, he was 5'2", wasn't it? 5'3". He wasn't very big. Mm. He had a couple of beers and became 6 foot tall, invisible and bulletproof. And consequently, he would be a hindrance to himself and an annoyance to other people. But, you know, he got himself into a lot of trouble, did a lot of silly things. And he was his own worst enemy. Steve, on the other hand, when he drank, became all kind of lovey and cuddly and stupid.
You should have been in the Faces.
Yeah, exactly. He was definitely a 70s rock star in an 80s band. He was Keith Moon. He was Ronnie Wood. He was all those kind of people all rolled into one, you know. And when somebody constantly, whether they're sober or drunk, comes in with magnificent songs, you tolerate them a lot more. And when they consistently own up and apologize for what they did the night before, you're more forgiving. And he was, you know, it's just, why are some people friends with you, and, you know, why are some people your friend and some people just acquaintances? Steve was, he was just a diamond geezer, as they'd say in London. You know, he really was a sweetheart. And that is the big difference, really. And he contributed to the group way more than he would give himself credit for. Consequently, in those kind of situations, you tolerate it a lot more.
Also, I very rarely remember Steve going on stage trying to perform in front of an audience the worse for drink. And as much as I liked Pete when he was sober, I can't say the same thing for him. I really can't, you know. And it's a question of respect to yourself, to your band members, and also, more importantly, to your paying public. You know, Steve liked to drink. Nobody knows that more than us. But he certainly, he did it after the show. He never compromised what he had to do on stage. And I think that also said a lot about Steve. And in an opposite effect, I suppose, it says a lot about Pete as well. You know, Pete was given a lot of chances. He really was. And he was starting to become detrimental to the actual unit. Steve never was that way. Steve had his own problems, but they were his own problems. And as much as we tried to help him within those problems, they were very rarely detrimental to the actual group and the progress of the group. He got to a stage, unfortunately, with Pete that it actually was. He was actually hurting a lot more people than himself.
the definitive version of Let It Go, originally on Def Leppard's second album, High and Dry, now is found on the DVD or Blu-ray with double CD called And There Will Be a Next Time, live from Detroit. The next best thing to being there, seeing and hearing Def Leppard today.
Hey, this is Joe Elliott of Def Leppard in the studio with Redbeard, and there will be a next time.
Thank you, Joe. When asked how Def Leppard can tear into material written in the early 80s with more fire and conviction than ever, Joe Elliott had a simple but revealing answer.
There's two ways of looking at that. When you record a song for the first time, or by the time you actually get it down on tape, you maybe played it a dozen times, you know. I mean, we've seen the Beatles anthology thing, and it'll say like take 29 or take 30. So maybe you do 30 takes, you know, but it's still fresh. It's new. You're learning it. When you come to playing a song 30 years, 35 years after it was released, it's now in your DNA. So for myself, Rick and Rick Savage, it is totally inbuilt in the DNA. We were there from its conception, and we'll be there at its demise, no doubt, as well. But for the other part of that equation is that it's two different guitar players to what played on the record. So they're listening to it with different heads than say, the two Ricks and myself, you know. Phil's always the one that's wanting to play the stuff of High and Dry because he's such a fan of the record that he appreciates what Steve and Pete Willis did on that album. And the same thing with Vivian, you know. So they bring a different flavor to it. Not any better, not any worse, just different, you know. But it does give it an edge, I suppose. And the fact that we can be playing that song 35 years after it was born with the same amount of enthusiasm as we did when we started out, if not more, I think it's a testament to the band that, you know, we're in it for the long haul, and that includes certain songs. Well, it's a band, you know. None of us think that we're the star, you know. As I've said before, when you've got five alpha males in a band, you have to realize who the boss is, and we quickly established that the boss is the song, you know, and we adapt ourselves to suit. So if you're approaching anything in life, sometimes you have to adapt on a minute-by-minute, an hour-by-hour, day-by-day basis to how you're going to approach whatever it is you're approaching, you know. And when it comes to doing certain songs, you know, there might not be many guitar parts in it, so the guys know they're going to be singing more than playing, and then there's other songs where they're playing more than singing. And it's not a case of there's anybody in this band says, I don't want to be in that kind of band. I just want to play guitar all night and I don't want to sing, or I want to sing and I don't want to play guitar. Everybody's got their role to play, and we approach each song with its own rules, if you like. And because of the ego-free situation that we've found ourselves in when it comes to this approach, it works terrifically for a band like us.
I reminded Joe Elliott about a debate in the music business about 15 years ago of the fear that making high-quality concert films for the growing home theater market would cannibalize actual concert ticket sales.
Maybe 15 years ago, for certain acts, it was deemed not a good idea. But I think everything seems to have settled down, and it doesn't seem to have done anybody any harm. I think I've always believed that people, no matter how much they lock themselves in their bedroom under headphones, as opposed to sharing the way that, say, we all did when MTV first kicked in around about 81, 82, you know, you'd sit down in your bedroom with your mates and watch the latest ZZ Top video for the cars, the girls, and the furry guitars sort of thing. Now everybody seems to be on their headphones. I think that somewhere in between there are enough people on the planet that actually want to rub shoulders with other human beings in a live environment. And I think that's why the live thing has got more popular, if not maintained its popularity. I think it maybe even got more popular. And that kind of makes that all null and void about, you know, DVDs and, you know, whatever format you want to talk about is going to kill music. It really isn't, I don't think. If anything, it may lead people to want to go and see them in actual live situations rather than just the 2D flat screen version. It's almost like become like a church. You know, it's a place where people get together Sunday mornings to worship whichever God they choose. And with rock music, it's where you go to celebrate the life's work of an artist, whether it be one album and that life's work is 6 or 7 months, or whether it be the Stones or, you know, McCartney, where you're looking at a 50-year career, or anywhere in between. I think that people just need contact, and sometimes that isolation just makes that more obvious.
You know, I was really impressed by how well the guys support you live with the call and response backing vocals. Who is that? It's really strong.
Well, the choruses on Animal, I sing the high harmony on the second half, but I let the crowd sing the first bit. You know, it's getting the crowd involved. We want them to be the sixth member of the band when we're playing live. We've always wanted them to do that. You know, I've done some shows outside of Leopard with people like, you know, Duff McKagan and Matt Sorum and Gilby Clark, who played with Guns N' Roses. And when we were in South America, we'd be doing some of our songs and some of their songs. And I remember Duff and Gilby coming up to me going, dude, people sing your stuff. They mosh to ours, but they sing your songs, you know, the whole crowd. And that's exactly how it is at a Leopard gig. And people sometimes don't even realize that, but the crowd is singing every word. So it's not just the choruses, they're singing the whole thing. But yeah, all three of the guys, the out front, you know, Rick doesn't sing. We took that responsibility off him because there's so much to be doing with his, you know, with his kit, and specifically with him being, you know, one man down in the arm department, as it were. We like to keep the whole anchors down, and we'll worry about the vocals. So the four of us, we split the things up, and people just take different parts, and I normally take the very high bits. So what we did on the record, all four of us and maybe Mutt around the mic singing the high harmony on a dozen times and multi-tracking it up, I get to do that all on my own. But it somehow works because the crowd kind of, they become your double track, you know.
Broken road.
from 2015, and now a kickin' live version on the Next Time, Live from Detroit DVD and CD. I asked Def Leppard lead singer, songwriter Joe Elliott a penny for his thoughts when he sees the song Bringin' On the Heartbreak pop up on the concert performance set list.
There are certain songs that they just mean so much, you know, not necessarily to us, but to the audience. And when we play that song, and we've done it a bunch of different ways, sometimes we do it acoustically, we're back to doing it electric, but when we start that song off with that kind of twin guitar lead intro, and you hear the crowd go bonkers, the same way that when you listen to a Zeppelin live record, the beginning of Stairway to Heaven kicks in and the crowd go bonkers, it's one of those songs. It was the first song to really be taken notice of back in 1982, a good year after we released it, because of the MTV video. The song started getting played on MTV, then he started getting requested on radio, and all of a sudden the song became like a minor hit, if you like, a year after it came out, and it's just grown and grown and grown ever since. It's a very important song in the Leppard catalogue, for sure.
One of the real treats to a Def Leppard concert is their impeccable choices in rock chestnuts to cover. You know, the right surprise left turn at the right time in the set. Such is the case when Def Leppard covers the 1973 David Essex song Rock On. Joe Elliott remembers hearing it for the first time on the radio in Sheffield, England.
Well, it was mind-blowing because it was a pop song, but it was done with a rock format. And that's what a lot of music that we heard in the UK was. You have to remember that unlike America, where you've got, you know, maybe 7 or 8 stations in each state, maybe 2 or 3 stations in each city, which should be on maybe 24 hours a day in FM, playing nothing but album tracks, all we had was one top 40 station nationwide, and that was it. And after that, you're tuning into classical music, talk radio that covers politics, or easy listening music like Andy Williams and Perry Como. So we were force-fed a mixture of Tie a Yellow Ribbon by Tony Orlando and Come On Feel the Noise by Slade and anything in between, you know. So we were limited into what we heard, unless you had an older brother with a great record collection, and because he was a student, which I didn't have, you know, or a mate down the corner of the street, which I did have, who was introduced me to the likes of Jethro Tull and Rod Stewart and all this kind of stuff. But the radio taught us 3-minute rock and roll. You know, I mean, there were big guitars on Rebel Rebel and Gene Genie and Metal Guru and Get It On. And there was big guitars on Come and Feel the Noise and Mama We're All Crazy Now, two songs ironically covered by an American band called Quiet Riot in the 80s, and were bigger hits for them than they ever were for Slade in America. But those big drums, big choruses, big guitars is what taught us who we are, you know. But we also had a, I wouldn't say a softer side, but we had an open ear for other types of music other than like what you might call full-on hard rock, you know. And David Essex had a bunch of stuff that was truly groundbreaking from a pop point of view, because it was incredible arrangements by, I forget who it was. It may have been Jeff Wayne, actually, who did War of the Worlds. But he had Mike Garson on keyboards, who played with David Bowie. He had Herbie Flowers on bass, who played with T-Rex and David Bowie. He had a great array of musicians around him. And songs like America and songs like Stardust and specifically Rock On were songs that we all, over the years when we've been discussing pop music, would all look at each other and go, that's a great song. There was none of that like, oh, that's just, you know, poncy pop music. It was like really cleverly done. So when we were choosing the songs to put on the Air album, you know, 99% of the media that cover us all the time would be expecting us to be playing stuff like Sabbath and Zeppelin and stuff like that. And it was just never, ever going to be that, you know. We wanted to show the world where we truly came from. So that's why we had stuff like Blondie, Badfinger, ELO, and David Essex on that record, along with Bowie and T-Rex. And there's Kinks, yeah, you know, like I say, they were staple stuff on the radio. In even when we were kids, I'll be the first to admit that when I was 6 or 7, I didn't really know why I liked the Kinks, but I know now why I liked them then, because I just had a musical ear that hadn't quite developed, but that was obviously my thing. I was just honed in to certain stuff, and when I heard the Kinks or the Who or the Small Faces, it stuck out more than Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Tremolos. It just did, you know, with the greatest respect to those last two artists. The Kinks were a real band, and Ray Davies, and to a lesser extent, Dave Davies, were really good songwriters, and they had a garage band punk sensibility that we didn't realize that then until you can get to compare it to what happened in 76. But you listen back and you realize that they were probably a band that were really admired by the likes of Lydon and Summer and Joe Strummer and all that kind of, you know, Sting and people like that. They were really awesome acts, you know. But at the same time, there was a great array of pop songs in the charts that really people, I know, I was one of them, would buy things like Crazy Horses by the Osmonds, but take it home in a brown paper bag so you didn't get beaten up at the bus stop, you know. We came from a different headspace where we didn't have to deny ourselves. You know, I mean, if you like the Bay City Rollers, you like the Bay City Rollers, you know. People in certain areas of the world cannot understand how somebody can say you really like David Essex and Led Zeppelin. And I'm like going, well, why not? You're just limiting yourself if you only like one type of thing. And that's why we've always had such a broad musical canvas to paint on, because we come from such different eclectic backgrounds within the realms of what pop and rock is. We have our influences, of course we do. What you do with them is what makes you the better than the other band that came up at the same time as you, or gives you that opportunity to outlast, because you have a natural born talent to take what were your influences and mix them in with your own, you know. So once he came up with this, you know, this basic, and he played it to Sav, and Sav went, give me the bass. And Sav starts playing it, and Rick starts playing the drums, and then Phil starts throwing in little chuggy guitar licks and stuff like that. we just put the basic track together. I've always said, and you can quote me here 1,000 times, I'm all for, you know, the answer my friend is blowing in the wind. God bless you. But, you know, she had a hubcap diamond star halo, which is what Mark Boland sung on, I think it was Get It On. You know, it's just like, what's one of those? And it's, the answer is, who cares? It sounds amazing. So that's a big part of our DNA as well, is just we want it to sound good. It's got to be phonetic. It's got to have a rappiness to it even, you know. So once we put that together and it's like, oh, this is just going in all the right directions for us. The English language is so ripe for picking when you say something that you don't mean or somebody else thinks that you mean something different to what you said. We try and incorporate that into our lyrics a lot. A lot of it comes from humor of, you know, John Cleese in Fawlty Towers, or the Three Stooges, or the Marx Brothers even. You know, we mix a lot of that in with all the sensible stuff. Keeps us sane, you know.
Joe, at the very end of your live performance of the song Hysteria, you did a touching musical nod to David Bowie. Tell me what David Bowie means and meant to you, first as a fan and later as a professional, you know, musician and performer.
But Top of the Pops was a massively important show for people of my generation because it was a 30-minute window into what's going on in the top 40. And the first time I saw Bowie play on Top of the Pops was when he did Starman from the Ziggy Stardust album. It would have been June, I'm guessing, 72. I was 12. And he was just an alien. I mean, you know, these days you see this stuff and, of course, you're worldly wise and you go, yeah, right, whatever. But back then, this, the red hair, the green suit, Mick Ronson, people of all walks and of life have said when he threw his arm around Mick Ronson's shoulder that their parents were horrified, you know. And we're thinking, I remember hearing stories about Alice Cooper horrifying parents and thinking this is a good thing, you know. It'll never happen again because the world's moved on. You know, I became a fan that day. And of course, then you go to school the next day and everybody's talking about this performance by David Bowie. And then, of course, when you save up your pocket money to go out and buy Ziggy Stardust, you kind of realize, and don't forget, we didn't have Wikipedia. We didn't have internet. You had to do it by word of mouth. We then discover that there's four other David Bowie albums to buy. You know, going backwards, you've got Hunky Dory. You've got Man Who Sold the World. You've got Space Oddity, which was originally called David Bowie. And then you've got the early Anthony Newley era sounding stuff that he did. There was just, you know, 5 or 6 hours of Bowie you could buy if you could afford it, you know. The same thing happened with Elton John. I think he probably broke on his fourth or fifth album. And the same thing with T-Rex. All these bands have been knocking around forever, but we never knew about it because they were never on Top of the Pops, see. So he became like an integral part of my life and has been ever since. I was very fortunate enough to meet him a bunch of times and he was always very gracious and very welcoming and almost kind of found it kind of funny that the guy that's in this supposed rock band was a big fan of him when most people that, you know, stood up to be counted were people like Robert Smith from The Cure or Holly Johnson from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Susie and the Banshees, you know, I mean, you could go Gary Newman, and then there was me. It was really weird. But he was great. He was really cool. And now I'm blessed that I did the last of three celebrating David Bowie shows with all the guys that have been in his band, from Mike Garson in 72 to Earl Slick joining in 74, all the way through to people like Gail Ann Dorsey, Mark Platy, Sterling Campbell, just did these shows. Two of them in the Wilton, they did a show in New York. I was at the London show and I did the two Wilton shows in LA and I got up and did Suffragette City, which just happened to be the first song Def Leppard ever played back in 77. And I did All the Young Dudes, which is, you know, the anthem of my generation. So I was blessed to be able to say thanks for everything you've given me back to him while he was sat up on the cloud watching us, hopefully.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests, Phil Collin, Rick Savage, and Joe Elliott. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2019. All rights reserved, transcription Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.